Chapter 165. We visit the court. It was about the middle of the second month of the Hijra, and therefore some 5 weeks after our arrival in Pardawiya, that we at last obtained admittance to the residence of the queen. It happened thus. There was a marquesan in the train of Pomeri who officiated as nurse to her children. According to the Tahitian custom, the royal youngsters are carried about until it requires no small degree of strength to stand up under them. But Marbana was just the man for this, large and muscular, well made as a statue, and with an arm like a degenerate Tahitian's thigh. Embarking at his native island as a sailor on board of a French whaler, he afterward ran away from the ship at Tahiti, where, being seen and admired by Pomeri, he had been prevailed upon to enlist in her service. Often, when visiting the grounds, we saw him walking about in the shade, carrying two handsome boys, who encircled his neck with their arms. Marbana's face, tattooed as it was in the ornate style of his tribe, was as good as a picture book to these young Pomeris. They delighted to trace with their fingers the outlines of the strange shapes there delineated. The first time my eyes lighted upon the marquesan, I knew his country in a moment, and hailing him in his own language, he turned round, surprised that a person, so speaking, should be a stranger. He proved to be a native of Tyre, a glen of New Kahiva. I had visited the place more than once, and so, on the island of Imeo, we met like old friends. In my frequent conversations with him over the bamboo picket, I found this islander a philosopher of nature, a wild heathen, moralizing upon the vices and follies of the Christian court of Tahiti, a savage, scorning the degeneracy of the people among whom fortune had thrown him. I was amazed at the national feelings of the man. No European, when abroad, could speak of his country with more pride than Marbana. He assured me, again and again, that so soon as he had obtained sufficient money to purchase 20 muskets, and as many bags of powder, he was going to return to a place with which Imeo was not worthy to be compared. It was Marbana who, after one or two unsuccessful attempts, at last brought about our admission into the queen's grounds. Through a considerable crowd, he conducted us along the pier to where an old man was sitting, to whom he introduced us as a couple of Auroris of his acquaintance, anxious to see the sights of the palace. The venerable chamberlain stared at us, and shook his head. The doctor, thinking he wanted a fee, placed a plug of tobacco in his hand. This was ingratiating, and we were permitted to pass on. Upon the point of entering one of the houses, Marbana's name was shouted in half a dozen different directions, and he was obliged to withdraw. Thus left at the very threshold to shift for ourselves, my companion's assurance stood us in good stead. He stalked right in, and I followed. The place was full of women, who, instead of exhibiting the surprise we expected, accosted us as cordially as if we had called to take our souchong with them by express invitation. In the first place, nothing would do, but we must each devour a calabash of ale, and several roasted bananas. Pipes were then lighted, and a brisk conversation ensued. These ladies of the court, if not very polished, were surprisingly free and easy in their manners, quite as much so as King Charles's beauties. There was one of them, an arch little miss, who could converse with us pretty fluently, to whom we strove to make ourselves particularly agreeable, with the view of engaging her services as cicerone. As such, she turned out to be everything we could desire. No one disputing her will, every place was entered without ceremony, curtains brushed aside, mats lifted, and each nook and corner explored. Whether the little damsel carried her mistress's signet, that everything opened to her thus, I know not, but Marbana himself, the bearer of infants, could not have been half so serviceable. Among other houses which we visited, was one of large size and fine exterior, the special residence of a European, formerly the mate of a merchant vessel, who had done himself the honor of marrying into the Pomeri family. The lady he wedded, being a near kinswoman of the queen, he became a permanent permanent member of Her Majesty's household. This adventure arose late, dressed theatrically in calico and trinkets, assumed a dictatorial tone in conversation, and was evidently upon excellent terms with himself. We found him reclining on a mat, smoking a reed pipe of tobacco, in the midst of an admiring circle of chiefs and ladies. He must have noticed our approach, but instead of rising and offering civilities, he went on talking and smoking, without even condescending to look at us. His Highness feels his poi, carelessly observed the doctor. The rest of the company gave us the ordinary salutation, our guide announcing us beforehand. In answer to our earnest requests to see the Queen, we were now conducted to an edifice, by far the most spacious, in the enclosure. It was at least 150 feet in length, very wide, with low eaves, and an exceedingly steep roof of pandanus leaves. There were neither doors nor windows, nothing along the sides, but the slight posts supporting the rafters. Between these posts, curtains of fine matting and tappa were rustling, all round. Some of them were festooned, or partly withdrawn, so as to admit light and air, and afford a glimpse now and then of what was going on within. Pushing aside one of the screens, we entered. The apartment was one immense hall, the long and lofty ridgepole fluttering with fringed matting and tassels, full 40 feet from the ground. Lounges of mats, piled one upon another, extended on either side. While here and there were slight screens, forming as many recesses, where groups of natives, all females, were reclining at their evening meal. As we advanced, these various parties ceased their buzzing, and in explanation of our appearance among them, listened to a few cabalistic words from our guide. The whole scene was a strange one, but what most excited our surprise was the incongruous assemblage of the most costly objects from all quarters of the globe. Cheek by jowl, they lay beside the rudest native articles, without the slightest attempt at order. Superb writing desks of rosewood, inlaid with silver and mother of pearl, decanters and goblets of cut glass, embossed volumes of plates, gilded candelabra, sets of globes and mathematical instruments, the finest porcelain, richly mounted sabers and fowling pieces, laced hats and sumptuous garments of all sorts, with numerous other matters of European manufacture, were strewn about among greasy calabashes half filled with rolls of old tappa and matting, paddles and fish spears, and the ordinary furniture of a Tahitian dwelling. All the articles first mentioned were, doubtless, presents from foreign powers. They were more or less injured. The fowling pieces and swords were rusted. The finest woods were scratched, and a folio volume of Hogarth lay open, with a cocoa nutshell of some moldy preparation capsized among the miscellaneous furniture of the rake's apartment, where that inconsiderate young gentleman is being measured for a coat. While we were amusing ourselves in this museum of curiosities, our conductor plucked us by the sleeve, and whispered, "Pommery, Pommery, Armai Coco." "She is coming to sup, then," said the doctor, staring in the direction indicated. "W, what say you, Paul, suppose we step up?" Just then a curtain nearby lifted, and from a private building a few yards distant the Queen entered, unattended. She wore a loose gown of blue silk, with two rich shawls, one red and the other yellow, tied about her neck. Her Royal Majesty was barefooted. She was about the ordinary size, rather matronly, her features not very handsome, her mouth, voluptuous, but there was a careworn expression in her face, probably attributable to her late misfortunes. From her appearance, one would judge her about 40, but she is not so old. As the Queen approached one of the recesses, her attendants hurried up, escorted her in, and smoothed the mats on which she at last reclined. Two girls soon appeared, carrying their mistress's repast, and then, surrounded by cut glass and porcelain, and jars of sweetmeats and confections, Pommery Vahinei, the titular queen of Tahiti, ate fish and out of her native calabashes, disdaining either knife or spoon. Come on, whispered Law Ghost, let's have an audience at once. And he was on the point of introducing himself, when our guide, quite alarmed, held him back and implored silence. The other natives also interfered, and, as he was pressing forward, raised such an outcry that Pomeree lifted her eyes and saw us for the first. She seemed surprised and offended, and, issuing an order in a commanding tone to several of her women, waved us out of the house. Summary as the dismissal was, court etiquette, no doubt, required our compliance. We withdrew, making a profound inclination as we disappeared behind the tapaeras. We departed the ground without seeing Marbana, and previous to vaulting over the picket, feed our pretty guide after a fashion of our own. Looking round a few moments after, we saw the damsel escorted back by two men, who seemed to have been sent after her. I trust she received nothing more than a reprimand. The next day Popo informed us that strict orders had been issued to admit no strangers within the palace precincts. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.